Right, good afternoon everyone and welcome to this meeting organised by the Socialist Party of Great Britain. Right, the title of the meeting this afternoon is Democracy, What It Is and What It Ain't. And I would like to point out first that the aim of the Socialist Party is socialism. And that is a worldwide ownership, common ownership by the whole of the world community of the earth and all its resources, as opposed to capitalism, which is based, of course, on sale and profit. Such a worldwide system can't be had without majority understanding. In other words, you need democratic means to get to socialism, which is by definition democratic. So without more ado, now I will ask Comrade Hedikar to speak.
Thank you. It's good to see you all here, old friends too. After all the kerfuffle of the election, it's a fitting subject, I suppose. I thought I'd seen the most abysmal election ever when Kinnock came on with his razzmatazz, but this one, in my opinion, beat the lot. Some of you who've known me a long time may know that back in the 60s, in a moment of inspiration, I tried to present a petition to Downing Street to ban nuclear tests under the Noise Abatement Act. Unfortunately, they refused to receive it. And similarly, I was talking to a Scottish friend the other day about the when I was in Scotland, to discover there's no law of trespass. And farmers have a way of preventing putting up various notices. And I had another inspired moment for a new petition, and I'm now going to present one that as you enter the House of Commons, a huge sign should be over the front saying, beware of the bull. Anyway, I better get on with the talk after that diversion. The word democracy, having favourable connotations, has been espoused almost universally with a reckless disregard for its original meaning. Demokratia, demos people, kratos power, people power, people power. Though this itself is open to a less benign translation. It is a word which in the course of time has wandered through a maze of distortion and misrepresentation. Many other words, peace, love, freedom, and of course socialism, have suffered a similar fate. Millions have died fighting for democracy without ever experiencing it or, alas, understanding it, except in the most superficial, state-sponsored way. We live in a world in which one-third of the population live under virtual dictatorships, in which oppression, torture and murder are practiced as a matter of routine. Yet of the 170 or more independent states that currently exist, about 90% either claim to be democratic or include the word democratic in their title. In a futile attempt to clarify things, official parlance divides them up as full democracies and flawed democracies. Tragically, many people remain willing to die for either of those fictions. Even in countries where regular elections are held, voters often face intimidation and sometimes bribery. The word elect derives from a Latin root meaning to choose. But what choice is a voter really offered? Most often, it equates to a condemned prisoner being asked to democratically choose between the rack, the wheel, and the fire, to which the only sensible answer is none of the above. I suspect that the definition of democracy offered by and acceptable to the majority of people would simply be a parliamentary system in which government is chosen by periodic elections allowing secret voting. the economist Joseph Schumpeter's classic 1942 definition was much nearer to the truth, certainly as regards capitalism. It described democracy as a competitive struggle for people's votes. Competitive struggle just about sums it up. Various agencies employed at vast cost by all political parties, at least by those who think they have a chance of winning, to market their ideas as though they were a washing powder, adapting policies and principles according to the latest market research. This is a far reliable resource at best. I remember back in the 60s when all the washing powder adverts were competing. There was the washing powder, some of you might remember, it might still be going, called Daz. And to compete with others, they brought out a new one. On the advice of market research, Daz with the new speckled blue whitener. A year later, there was a consumer research produced which showed original Daz was second and new Daz with the brilliant blue speckled whitener was next to bottom of all the washing powders. So much for market research, and we saw what it did in this election too. Every country on earth practices censorship, secrecy, and deception, fundamental denials of democracy. All governments, elected governments the same as any other, pursue actions, spying, blackmail, fraud, robbery, murder, which are forbidden to individuals. Extreme measures and oppressive laws invoked to defend the state against internal or external threats, real or imagined, invariably prove disastrous for the working class. Hard-won liberties can be suspended or altogether removed under any circumstance an elected government decrees a state of emergency. Dissemination of information becoming still more controlled than ever today. You know, when people think of Marx, and we are a Marxian party, they often think turgid words and long economic theories, but he wrote some lovely things, and this is one about the dissemination of knowledge, which I think is absolutely lovely, and it may surprise you. Truth should be as penetrating as light. Can freedom allow no colour scheme but a dirty off-white? The fusion of a sunbeam with a tiny drop of dew will produce a dazzling and brilliant array of colours. Should the fusion of the sun of intellect with the dewdrop of the mind produce only one, the official colour? That is a beautiful piece that Marx wrote. He wrote other bits like it, but nobody ever quotes, and it appeals to the poet in me, because, of course, he was rooted in philosophy anyway. So we see today how the dissemination of knowledge is being more and more controlled. And it was a contention of Aristotle, any democracy put to the strain is supplanted by oligarchy. Under capitalism, democracy invariably results in regrettably large numbers of the working class abdicating their responsibility to the ballot box and conceding power with a cross, thereby colluding in the whole ludicrous charade, and permitting the ruling class, with its labyrinthine network of delicate but carefully constructed power balances, to govern by means of an institutional pluralism, carefully hidden from the electorate. Bertrand de Jouvenel expressed it in his book On Power. Elections are no more than a plebiscite by which the whole people puts itself in the hands of a small gang. Also, more cuttingly, a society of sheep must sometime beget a government of wolves. Yet at the same time, the prevailing ideas of government continue to pervade our daily lives. Through art, literature, theatre, publishing, broadcasting, perceived morals, education, and increasingly, technology. The distorting glow of the cathode ray tube, bringing the desired persuasions of our rulers right into our homes. TV screens of ever-expanding dimensions, skillfully presenting, as in the case of many recent military involvements, a warped but powerfully persuasive establishment presentation of what they want you to hear. And on a regular basis, that routine violation of truth comes into our rooms every day. It is commonly referred to as the news. To serve this purpose, all in the name of free choice, huge broadcasting concessions are granted to powerful media tycoons in the certain knowledge that their support. Some producing programs of abysmal quality designed to appeal to the lowest common denominator. In phony political doublespeak, this is referred to as giving the people what they think they want. Obviously, not all programs are of poor quality, for that would be counterproductive to the establishment. But not many, not too many, are informative and truly challenging, and never too often than they think is good for us. Any controversial opinion is usually contained within generally agreed and well-confined safe parameters. Genuine alternatives, questioning the fundamental proposition of the market economy, capitalist exploitation, or the desirability of money-based security, hard-working aspiration. Sorry, oh God, I got the words wrong there. I hadn't been listening enough. These are rarely permitted. It is indeed a mistake to assume that the act of voting of itself will affect in any significant way the continuing manipulation and exploitation of the electorate. For people to believe that by some strange alchemy, some act of magic, this lot will not deceive and manipulate like the last lot is very disappointing. For those in power, it is the Machiavellian ideal to create that illusion of freedom whilst never for a moment relinquishing control. Perpetuating this illusion by falsely presenting what are interchangeable political parties as deadly rivals offering real change. For some voters, it must be said, the whole exercise is driven by a negative reaction, a sizable percentage motivated simply by the desire to keep one disastrous party out, rather than being inspired by the pre-election ideals and vision of the equally disastrous party they decide not to support. Others vote hoping that one party might give them some specific advantage to suit their material purpose. But negative or positive, such popular consent is the means by which capitalist politicians, who by the rules of the game, the circumstances of power, are bound to act frequently against the interests of those they claim to serve, negative or positive, such popular consent turn the electorate into their accomplices. The fraud which is capitalist democracy provides a ready justification for whatever action best serves the system. Even if a party was elected with high-minded principles, it would be compelled to act against those principles, to betray their supporters in order to retain power. For there are only two rules in the game of capitalist democracy. The first rule is the acquisition of power, and any other words are subordinate to that aim. Having acquired power, the new priority is the retention of power. They cannot give up those two basic things. That is the name of the game. And you can't be in power, A, without wanting to acquire it, most of all, and B, without wanting to retain it, most of all. And as we've seen in the election, any half-truth, any lie, any insult, very few actual hard policies. Aldous Huxley, in his book, The Brave New World, summed it up brilliant when this controlled world, when Bernard Marx eventually confronted Mustafa Mon, the Grand Controller, and found that he had all the things that were denied to the population because he knew the rules of the game. And when asked to explain it, he hit upon an idea of contrasting the two great recreations. And he said, I quote, "You've got to stick to one set of postulates, dear boy. You can't play electromagnetic golf according to the rules of centrifugal bumble puppy. And you can't play power politics according to the rules of true democracy." It is unfortunate that even where capitalist democracy appears to tolerate minority opinion, it only does so for as long as its advocates remain sufficiently ineffectual to allow their deviation without undue risk to the state. Indeed, the intolerance often shown by the majority of the population against the minority attitudes frequently serves as an excuse for their suppression on the grounds that they threaten the core stability of society by undermining its fundamental beliefs. Ironically, but all too rarely, the truth about this wonderful political democracy is expressed most succinctly by its own advocates. In a letter to his friend, the artist Duncan Grant, whose beautiful house in Sussex I recommend a visit to, his charming establishment, Maynard Keynes once wrote, "I work for a government I despise and for ends that I think criminal." It was his job. And that abysmal American president Woodrow Wilson opined, "The truth is that we are all caught in a great economic system which is heartless, out of the mouths of babes." The splendidly succinct Oxford Dictionary definition of the state, the body politic organized for supreme civil rule and government, equally embraces every form of government, essentially uniting them all in a common cause, whether they are styled democratic, totalitarian, or despotic. I must be careful not to exaggerate then in my summing up of this introduction. So, choosing my words carefully, capitalist democracy conveniently serves corrupt, cheating, lying, murdering, warmongering, callous, oppressive and exploitative rulers of a grossly unjust and obscene political system, and that goes all over the world. Okay, so in that case, why do socialists vote? That's a good question, isn't it? With all this is wrong with the system, why do we vote? Firstly, because the only reasonable, practical, desirable and realistic springboard for any fundamental change to the present system is the universal franchise. One person, one vote. But how can one person, one vote be meaningful when even where it is established, some are millionaires and most are paupers? Yet we may also ask that if the right to vote is so meaningless, why are those in power so reluctant to grant it and only do so under pressure? And even where they do, take care to ensure that sufficient information necessary to enable the electorate to make an informed choice is never provided. Critics argue, of course, that this only confirms their position, that the entire electoral system is a sham. The concept of universal suffrage, an irrelevance, a trap to lure the unwary into the artfully spun web of capitalism and state control. That the moment anyone enters the arena of power and politics, with all its attendant paraphernalia of posturing, ego-tripping leaders, whips, and fiercely imposed party lines, they become hopelessly compromised. That once you have cast your vote for Tweedledum or Tweedledee, you thereby offer tacit agreement to the very process that keeps us all enslaved. Let us be honest and admit that, as we have seen, these are powerful points, not to be lightly dismissed. They must be persuasive. God damn it, I argued them myself for almost 30 years, and they persuaded me for a long time. But of course there are ways of participating in this democratic process without contributing to the machinations of the establishment. Aha, our opponent might explain triumphantly. Even if that were possible, which we don't accept, you socialists actually go the whole hog and field candidates. This we do. But there is an important, a very important qualification. Unlike any other candidates, serious candidates, we do not seek to form a government, and we do not want power. The only power socialists demand is that over themselves. On the contrary, we vigorously campaign against all forms of government, nor are we bedazzled by the electoral shenanigans, not for us the phony promises of other parties. In fact, the only promise we can make to voters is that if elected, we will do nothing for them. Not because we are all unfeeling swine. Well, not most of us. Some of us, perhaps. But because our interest is to convince the electorate that change, real change, can only occur when they decide to do something about it themselves, not rely on the lying, cheating, double-dealing alleged representatives. Also, we consider it to be absolutely vital to show our support and encouragement to fellow workers in other countries, where the struggle for the right to vote often leads to imprisonment, torture, or death. Or those places where, instead of apathy, disillusionment, cynicism, or plain work-related fatigue causing them to neglect their hard-won franchise, they actually queue for days and hours to vote. Non-participation by those of us who do have the chance is not only a betrayal, but tragically mistaken. The reason governments are wary of free elections, well, fairly free elections, not very free elections, is that deep down themselves, whatever they pretend, they know it is the one process with the capacity to end their supremacy once and for all by a popular vote. And since they themselves are incessantly trumpeting their commitment to the democratic ideal, the more we cement it by our active participation, the harder it becomes for them to abandon that right. Although, of course, they seek any opportunity to do so. Already we have seen that politicians and commentators are suggesting that in the case of trade unions, a low turnout voting in favour of a strike should not be taken as sufficient approval to validate it. Heaven forbid they should ever apply this criteria to parliamentary elections, because none of them would ever take a seat. Another double-edged sword, I think. Another position sometimes advanced is that democracy only matters once a socialist society has been achieved. Foolish and dangerous argument. Article 19 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights says this: everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media, regardless of frontiers. Nobody of sound mind imagines this declaration is vigorously pursued in any country. In most, regrettably, it is studiously ignored. But where we can, we should surely use it and quote it to test and challenge its intention, especially in view of that phrase, regardless of frontiers. In the struggle to prevent free exchange on the internet and prevent government agencies controlling it, we need to be ever more vigilant. As socialists, we should welcome and strive to extend and consolidate every concession to free communication and assembly conceded by governments and international authorities, however inadequate we think they are. Inadequate in the sense both referring to concession and government. Any alternative proposal for fundamental change, any alternative than the ballot box, is unreasonable, impractical, undesirable, and unrealistic. We have all of us at some time encountered the wild-eyed, ranting buckets of blood mount the barricades would-be people's heroes who view the prospect of a popular uprising through a rose-coloured romantic haze. We know that ain't the truth. Not all, or even most of those who favour the forceful overthrowing of the state, however, fit that stereotype. Many are thoughtful, sincere, rational people who genuinely believe that waiting for change through the ballot box is impossibly utopian, who are convinced that such a process of prolonged persuasion only plays into the hands of our rulers, ensuring them of everlasting security of tenure in the halls of power. Many of them reason that with the ever-increasing spread of nuclear capability and the relentless and uncaring destruction of the environment, time is a luxury that we can ill afford. They are convinced that armed revolution is the only method which would enable an immediate and secure seizure of control. That any signs of a significant will for change, evidence at the ballot box, would be quickly subverted by the state, if necessary, by military intervention. I must say, I have always regarded the proposition that overthrowing a government because you deplore their method of violent suppression by violent suppression as seriously misguided at best and dangerously loopy at worst. Those who advocate it must be hooded and blinkered not to be aware of the inevitable and tragic consequences. For as past experience has repeatedly demonstrated, power obtained by violent struggle inevitably needs to be maintained by an oppressive combination of military posturing, armed policing, lying, spying, informing, imprisoning, threatening, torturing, and executing, strangely similar to that practiced by the corrupt and vicious regime that was previously in control. Rebels and radicals who fail to conform to the new authoritarianism are likely to be crushed with even greater ferocity than was ever manifested by those whom they have overthrown. Invariably, such attempts are led by a so-called revolutionary vanguard, self-appointed leaders usually, with a 100% strike rate at totally betraying their luckless followers. Power acquired by violence must inevitably be defended by violence, because it will be threatened constantly from outside, below, and within. Cooperation cannot be enforced forever by coercion. However ruthless, and those who try it are only sowing the seeds of their eventual demise, for they are the make the mistake of treating those they govern with contempt, though sometimes it may seem justified. Though there can be no doubt that anyone who has suffered from the new government, it must seem a long time before that reversal comes around. True enough, even in the most developed democratic society, mistakes and misjudgments will always be made. But unlike those that are based upon coercion, and since there will be no absolute truth of any kind, the attendant hostilities engendered by the irresistible force of violent revolution encountering the immovable object of entrenched ideology will not be present. An altogether nobler, worthier, though sadly similarly naive notion is that change will occur when evolved human beings individually develop enlightened attitudes of cooperation. But without the need for any political forethought about democracy or administration when that time comes. Obviously, should by some astounding circumstance such a situation occur without having given forethought to how such a society would be run, it would be chaos. Having loftily disdained the necessity of understanding the complex nature of modern industrial society, and hopelessly deficient in an understanding of how to administer things, global priorities, and such, they would be unable to do very much but live in that chaos. This is because, and let me say that many of my old friends embrace this perspective, they have seriously erred by treating the concept of democracy as purely political. That is a serious error, which brings me to my final point. The concept of democracy cannot be purely political unless a true spirit of democracy is reflected in our personal attitudes, integrated to it, our philosophy, morality, lifestyle, call it what you will, as individuals, it will be unable to function effectively as an acceptable arbiter of social disputes without having to resort to some kind of overriding authority. William Morris saw this very clearly, and every place visited in his book about a future society, News from Nowhere, is veritably imbued with this democratic spirit. With a charming, though frequently highly opinionated manner of exchanging points of view, yet every discussion displaying a deep and mutual regard for the right to differ. Listen to the beautiful way he explains it. Said I, so you settle these differences, great and small, by the will of the majority, I suppose. Certainly, said he. How else would we settle them? You see, in matters which are merely personal, which do not affect the welfare of the community, how a man shall dress, what he shall eat and drink, and what he shall write and read and so forth, there can be no difference of opinion, and everybody does as he pleases. But when the matter is of interest to the whole community, and the doing or not doing something affects everybody, the majority must have their way. In a society of men who are free and equal, the apparent majority will be the real majority, and others, as I have hinted before, know too well to obstruct from mere pig-headedness, especially as they have plenty of opportunity for putting their side of the question. In a letter to Commonweal, the Journal of the Socialist League, he wrote this, experience shows that whenever a dozen thoughtful men shall meet together, there will be 12 different opinions on any subject which is not a dry matter of fact, and probably on that as well. The accuracy of this observation, anybody who's been to the pub with us socialists will know it's very true. Morris was well aware that democracy could not be left to mature on its own like a fine wine. It needs to breathe, to live out of the bottle, kept fresh by continual practice. This is something we endeavour to do in this socialist party, but we cannot honestly claim that it's easy to get everything right. Long experience has shown us how hard it is to be truly democratic. Since we assert that a stateless society is a viable proposition and recognise democracy as essential to its function, we are obliged to pursue it now, this day, this hour, this minute, better to understand its complexities and the difficulties that can arise. Unquestionably, even the most enlightened community, because it would depend upon the cooperation of free and potentially awkward human beings, minorities would sometimes experience dissatisfaction and frustration, giving rise to what anarchists darkly refer to as the tyranny of the majority. To deny this proposition and possibility would be absurdly complacent, so we don't do so. Anarchists, of course, might contend that in democracy the majority actually constitutes authority. And Morris concedes, for all that it's worth, it might be so defined. But when free, uncoerced human beings voluntarily enter into a process where inclusive, open, and if necessary, prolonged debate concludes with a majority decision, to describe it as authoritarian is the logic of the absurd. To call it tyranny, a word redolent with connotations of oppression and cruelty, makes a mockery of language. Later in the same letter, a dagger thrust is observed. For if freedom means the assertion of the advisability or possibility of an individual man doing what he pleases in all circumstances, that is negation of society. But it's true that one of the problems we are really going to face if such a society arrives is how we treat minorities. That is such an important question. And even in our social life, it ain't easy. And I've got a perfect illustration. I used to live in a house full of young, active young men, with tastes that were largely different from mine. Most of them were ardent royalists, but they were lovely people. And we took a decision one day. We would go to the movies once a month. Easy, democratic, all agreed. Then it came to the choice of film. I wanted to see some film noir, black and white, from the 30s or 40s or 50s. They wanted to see the Matrix. So, of course, we started off 3-1, off they go. Now, if in my house it had been a majority decision every time, that would not have been democracy, would it? It would not have been fair. So to talk of the concept of democracy not embracing minority opinion, it is the essential element that in any kind of democracy, free dissemination, absolute, unlimited time must be given to the members of that society. Sometimes people got mad at conference when some comrades repeatedly brought up the same subject. I never got mad. I don't care how many times they bring it up. If it's what they believe, bring it up. You might persuade someone. You never know. That's what's called democracy. Sometimes we have to put up with the same subject being brought up. But that's the price of democracy. And it's a price worth paying. So we must curb ourselves when this happens. Oh, not him again. Not her again. One of the most finishing in a moment, be pleased to hear. One of the most pernicious untruths ever perpetrated is that there exists some unbridgeable chasm between independence and cooperation. In socialism, strong, lively, independent individuals will understand very well that generous cooperation is a prerequisite for the continual flourishing of the kind of community that will enable them to fully enjoy the freedom they desire. We must always consider now and in the future the effects of the freedom that we practice upon other people. No one will surely choose to isolate themselves in the very community they have created. It is not free individuals who cause and practice the violence, corruption and greed that are inherent to capitalism, but those who are unfree. When human beings are free, they will possess a much greater awareness of choice and more profoundly understand the liberating dynamic of their creative potential. When this brilliant power that we all possess to externalize our imagination is no longer frustrated within this rotten society, it will truly revolutionize our behavior. Socialists are certainly looking to the future, but we are no idle dreamers. Conscious idealism informs and energizes our practical living every day of our lives. At least I hope so. Socialism and democracy are complementary. More than complementary, they are indivisible. Human consciousness, and this is the mistake the rulers make, they look at us now, but human consciousness is not static. The capacity to change is the trump card of the human species. We must never allow such a priceless bequest to fall hostage to the lunatic world in which we live, of market manipulation and state control that presently masquerades as reality and democracy.